So often in life, it's our heritage, our roots that guide our everyday thinking. And is that ever the case for our guest today as we launch yet another episode of Musings on Golf? Hello and welcome back to more great storytelling. My name is Kelly Elbin, my co-host, the one and only Bob Bupka, the voice of golf for TalkSport in the UK. As for our guest today, well, his name is David McClay Kidd, and his Scottish lineage and passion for links golf were absolutely the driving force behind the incredible Band and Dunes layout that he designed in Oregon a quarter century ago. Today, as Band and Dunes remains one of the finest links courses in the nation, Kidd has begun work on a new design across the country at the acclaimed Streamsong Resort in Florida. Bob, I know you're very proud of your roots. You're a fantastic storyteller. You and I had a great talk with David Kidd. Man, are our listeners ever going to enjoy hearing from a guy who not only never forgot his roots, but based on what he's created out there, the American golfers are the true beneficiaries of David Kidd.
Yeah, he created a golfing paradise, and he deserves a lot of credit. Nobody, but nobody, would take a look at that property and think that Band and Dunes could come as a result of that. But it's a magnificent golfing property. David has a lot to be proud of.
So there's a gentleman named Mike Kaiser who really was the financial backer and the visionary, the grand visionary of what became Band and Dunes. And he hired David Kidd. David Kidd is the son of Jimmy Kidd. Jimmy Kidd, one of the really great golf course superintendents in all of the UK, Bob. He was at Glen Eagles Resort for many years, extremely well known, highly respected. His son worked at his dad's footsteps. He learned the craft, but not only did he learn the craft, Bob, he understood Scottish golf and the heritage of links golf. And that's so important. Such a great appreciation that he's passed along when he put together Band and Dunes.
Yeah, you would think it would be impossible to take Scottish golf and plant it on the west coast of the United States. But that's what happened, and it happened in very fine fashion.
Yeah, and it's a rugged piece of land in southern Oregon, right on the Pacific Ocean. And since then, they've built six more courses, all of them walking courses. And I love one of their taglines, Bob. It's the soul of the game out there. You're not out there for necessarily commercial or business purposes. You're out there with your buddies. You're out there with your spouse. You're passionate about the game. You're walking the elements. Just like, Bob, you've talked so many times about going over to the old sod and St. Andrews and what that means and seeing the people walking the golf courses and the crazy bounces you see. Well, that's exactly what he's tried to replicate and has done so successfully out at Band and Dunes.
Yeah, nobody would ever think it's possible what he created. David did an outstanding job. And he is to be congratulated many, many, many times over.
Yeah, very naturalistic, taking just the land and being creative from that. We're going to hear from David in just a minute. Bob, we're also going to talk after the interview about, you know, a good deal of luck that came Brian Campbell's way at the tour event in Mexico. But you know what? His story, the story of Brian Campbell, is well beyond luck. Talk about perseverance. I was really happy for the guy. Bob, it was 180-some PGA Tour and Korn Ferry Tour events that he played in, and he'd never even had a top 10, Bob, and then he wins in a playoff where a ball ricochets off the woods, looks like it's going out of bounds on the second hole, and goes on and beats long-hitting Aldrich Potgieter to win his first PGA Tour event. It was a pretty cool experience for a very short-hitting guy.
Yeah, good things happen to good people. That's the only thing I can say.
Well, you've heard enough from us. David McClay Kidd, he's a pilot also, and you're going to hear some of that. Fascinating guy, kind of a man for all seasons, if you will. And you'll hear from David McClay Kidd right after you hear from our corporate friends at William & Harry and Titleist. Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com.
Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are the best performing, most consistent in the game. So how does the best get better? You start by listening to the best players in the world. You experiment, iterate, validate. You trust the best process to create the best golf ball the game has ever known. The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. More speed off the tee. More control with your irons. More spin with your wedges. And more opportunity to shoot your lowest scores.
Bob, our special guest today is rooted deep in his Scottish heritage and his vast knowledge of the land and his ability to use it effectively led to the creation of the magnificent Bandon Dunes hard by the Pacific Ocean in Oregon. The proud son of an acclaimed golf course superintendent, he continues to create courses with the goal of making them as natural as possible, as seamless as possible, and as sustainable as possible. Indeed, the possibilities seem endless with the outstanding golf course architect, David McClay Kidd. David, really happy to have you here on Musings on Golf. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. And you missed one. Fun. That's high on my list these days. I want to make sure that golf is fun and not a chore. So that's my other one I'd add.
Is that because it's a hard enough game to begin with type thing, David?
My father told me as a kid growing up in Scotland that golf is like life. It's just not fair.
How true is that?
Yeah.
Pop up here.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. I'm here in snowy, cold Oregon, central Oregon.
Yeah.
So we're well below freezing. We've got maybe a foot of snow on the ground. So not much golf getting played here.
You know what I call Bend, Oregon now, Myrtle Beach of the West Coast of the United States. What a job you have done out there at Bandon Dune. I mean, absolutely incredible. I mean, everybody that goes there comes back and says, man, they don't believe that that could be created on that property like it is. Great job, my friend.
Thank you. I got the ball rolling, but there were plenty of other people that followed behind and built on the first one. So I'm thrilled to, they can chisel that logo in my tombstone. I'll be happy.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Kaiser and his vision for Bandon Dunes and for all the properties out there, David. But before we, let's step back a little bit of time, please. I mentioned about you being the son of a really outstanding golf course superintendent, your dad, Jimmy. Your career in golf really started. You worked with him. He managed the courses at Glen Eagles in Scotland for a quarter century. I wonder what was that like for you, not only working for your dad, but learning from him as a kid?
You know, I realize now in my late 50s, how much I absorbed as a young child that I probably wasn't aware of. When you're getting up early at the weekends to go rake the bunkers, you quickly figure out, you know, what makes a good bunker good, what makes it bad, what makes it look cool when the sun's coming up, or what makes it not drain when it rains hard or it freezes. So all these things that I learned that I didn't know I was learning as a young kid on these golf courses in Scotland. And then my father is so immersed in the game. He loves the history of the game. So our house was filled with old hickory shafted clubs and books and maps and all sorts of stuff that he was saving and gathering from the 60s all the way up till the present day. I mean, he was collecting this stuff when no one was collecting it, and it was laying around our house. So I it really was sort of burnt into my DNA, and I think that's why Bandon came out the way it did. Was as a 20 something when I built it, it wasn't like I knew what I was doing. It was just instinct. I couldn't have written you a book about what I was doing. I probably could barely have explained to you at that time what I was doing. I just knew what was right and what was wrong. I knew that fairways could be rumpled and fescue could grow everywhere and bunkers could be pot bunkers. And I knew these things without being able to articulate it. So it was all just very raw instinct that spilled out onto that land. And I'm forever grateful for that education that I didn't really know I was getting. I cursed my father all those weekends raking bunkers in February in Scotland in the freezing cold. And yet that upbringing led to me being able to do what I do today. It was definitely a price worth paying.
You owe him a big apology. I know that much.
I do. I thank him all the time. There was a time not very long ago, maybe a few years back, my dad had a moment and he said to me, I regret the fact that I work so much. I was working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. I maybe didn't spend as much time with my children as I should have done. And I pulled my dad up right away and I said, please don't ever apologize for that. Do you know the work ethic that you taught me? I saw you work tirelessly, day in and day out, passionate about what you did. And that burnt into me. I could see how much you loved it. I could see the joy it gave you. And yet I could see the effort you were willing to expend to do it. And that's a lesson I wish and hope that I could pass to my own children.
Now, David, what a great feeling that is for you to have seen that. I mean, I look, I'm the son of an outstanding PGA professional himself, and I understand what you're saying. I was forced to wake up many Saturdays and Sundays and caddy at my dad's club, so I get it, right? But those lessons, man, and that ability to then be able to, man, if you can pass that along to your kids, not everybody gets to have that, David, and it's pretty darn cool when you have it, and it literally lasts a lifetime.
It sure does. It sets you up for success. It makes you resilient. You realize that, when you get a massive thunderstorm on a Saturday night and the final round of the club championships the next day, I would see my dad, pull his hair out, but just knuckle down and deal with it. And you realize when you see your own parents doing that, especially a parent that's dealing with the nature, right? Like my dad and your dad, Mother Nature takes no prisoners sometimes, and you just have no control. And so they would have to deal with things at a moment's notice, and still have the member come up at the end of the tournament and say, the course was pretty good, but the garbage can on 14 still had litter in it. You're like, are you kidding, dude? Do you know how much work went into getting the golf course presentable today? And your one complaint is the garbage can on the 14th.
Always something, right?
Something. My father would tell me if the complaints were little like that, then they had no idea the achievements that had been made to allow their game to proceed, which is right. And I tell my own team that. I said, we don't get to make excuses to the golfer that shows up here 10 years from now about why this hole is lesser, or why, there's something that's just not great about this golf course. We don't have that luxury. So we don't have any excuses. We have to find a way to make every course exceptional. And nobody cares about what struggles we have, that we have the driest summer or the wettest winter. No one cares. So we just have to knuckle up and find solutions so that on opening day and a decade later and decades later, the golf course is exceptional. That's all anyone cares about, and the only legacy we want to leave.
What's the greatest golf course you ever played, David?
Austin, greatest golf course. It's everybody wants to lean into, the Cypress Points and the Pine Valleys. But for me, the greatest golf course I've ever played and continue to play is the old course at Macrahanish. It's old Tom Morris built it in the late 1800s. I learned golf there. I spent endless summers there with my cousins and grandparents and aunts and uncles and my father. The golf course has a million lessons to teach a golfer and a budding golf course designer. And for me, it's still wrapped up in all of these childhood memories. I just spent so much time there and loved every moment. And when I go back these days, I dearly love the place. And for this Americans that go to Scotland and they play all the A-list courses, I always say, hey, if you're going back a second time, drive down the Mullaghcyntyre Tyre and spend a day or two at Macrahanish and play the old Tom Morris course and the young David course. I got to build one right next door to old Tom. So the place, for me, the old Tom Morris golf course there is the greatest course I ever played, but it might not be for the reasons that others might pick. It might not be the most amazing history or the most amazing strategy, but it has all of that. It just isn't a rival to, say, Cypress Point or Pine Valley.
Well, you've mentioned old Tom Morris. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, he was the very first golf course superintendent. Is that correct?
First superintendent and maybe the first golf pro. I mean, he was the golf pro, club maker, greenkeeper. I mean, he was all things. And yet never an RNA member. So that always makes me chuckle. You think about they now have a statue to old Tom on the links at St Andrews, but he was I think he was either an I think he was a new course member. And that's where he hung out.
So you were, when you were talking about your dad and being at home and growing up and so forth, I mean, the names Old Tom Morris and Harry Vardon and James Braid, I mean, they must have echoed through your house as a kid. Those were not just superintendent. Those were some of the great names in golf, period, at that time, way back when, right?
Yeah, I mean, James Braid to me as a kid growing up and loving golf and golf design was the equivalent of Mackenzie to the same kid here in the States. So people always want to talk to me and say, well, who's your inspiration? Is it, CB McDonald or Mackenzie or whatever? And I'm like, no, because none of those people worked in the UK. It was James Braid and Colt and Old Tom. These were the people, these were the courses I got to see and play. And these were their history was the history that my father was diving deep into and had books and maps laying around. So those were the inspirations that I had, even though it was 100 plus, well, about 100 years later that I was looking at this stuff. So when I came to the US and was learning about the golden age of architecture here in the US, it was a decade or two after that same golden age had happened in the UK, which was from pre-World War II into just after World War II. Sorry, World War I. World
World War One,
War
yeah,
II,
right.
1910 through sort of 1925.
You had an unusual way of learning your trade. They really didn't have golf course design schools back then, am I right?
No, I read a book probably when I was still in college that Robert Trent Jones Sr. had written. I can't quite remember. It was like a coffee table book. And in that book, he talked about his education and the fact that in the post-World War II, he wanted to be a golf course architect. And obviously, there was no way of studying to be one. So he kind of made up his own doctorate in golf course architecture. He decided what he needed to study and who he needed to learn from and where he needed to go. And he kind of cobbled together his own PhD kind of. And I took some inspiration from that and thought, okay, I can't do that either here in Scotland. What could I do? And so I did the same thing. I traveled, I played courses, I spoke to lots of people. I probably spent most of my 20s learning and learning and learning. And the amazing thing was, in the second half of my 20s, I got to meet Mike Kaiser and got to create Bandon Dunes, which opened when I was 30. So, an amazing number of happenstances, luck, and opportunity together with, right time, right place, right upbringing. I mean, it's just so many things came together that were, I mean, some of them were, weren't luck, but a bunch of them were. I can't deny it.
It's amazing to me. I have never spoken to anybody that's had the pleasure and honor and prestige of playing out at Bandon Dunes without just glowing, I mean, simply glowing comments about the golf course.
Well, I think it was somewhat unusual. You know, I came to the US as a student in probably the late 80s, early 90s, and I went to see the courses that were being built in the US at that point. And they were largely being, the architecture was golf tour pros, and it was largely housing developments. And I went to see these courses, and they were alien to me. They didn't look like anything I was used to from Scotland. And I thought, is this really what golf is? Is this really what Americans want in their golf courses? These narrow corridors caught between houses with bunkers and lakes and flower beds. I mean, and cart paths. Is this what golf is here? I really railed against it. I was here with my father, and he said, no, this isn't golf. This is some alien thing that they've lost the plot. This is not what golf should be. And so when I met Mike Kaiser, and he said he wanted to build a golf course in the image of a classic Scottish Irish links course, I painted out to him what I believe the things were that made a true links course. You know, you weren't going to have any artifice. You were going to allow the fairways to heave and tumble, and you were going to allow the ground game to really be part of it, because the wind prevents you putting the ball in the air very much. And Mike said, yeah, that's exactly what I want. So Bandon became kind of ground zero, even though Sandhills in Nebraska came before it, because it was private. So few people saw it. When Bandon happened, and it was public, it really touched a raw nerve for golfers in a good way. Golfers came and experienced it, and it was so alien to them in the other direction that they were seeing this very raw golf course in the United States. And they were saying, well, this is what I travel all the way to Scotland to play, and here it is on my doorstep. This is great. Yes. I love this. And suddenly I think the rock had been thrown in the lake, and the ripples started to move out, and it started to affect other designers. I think developers realized that they didn't have to lean towards Augusta necessarily. If they had a site that was good, they could create a golf course that embraced the site and was part of the site and had its sense of place and didn't have to be just a cookie cutter imprint. And I think we're still in that phase. I think history is going to show that 25 years ago, Bandon gets created, and that wave of change has taken a couple of decades to really set in hard. And I hope that it continues to do so, because, you know, golf needs that. We need to have a lighter hand on the land. Golfers need to embrace the landscape they're in and understand that a big part of the game is loving being in the great outdoors and in nature and reveling in what's around you. It's not about playing through a garden. So I hope that history will show that Bandon was the start of something, but we're far from the end of it.
But that was a fabulous response. We're joined by the terrific golf course architect David McClay Kidd here on Musings on Golf. David, I want to read something to you and then a question. I looked at the Bandon Dunes website. It's really, really terrific. There's a quote from you kind of front and center on there, and it reads as follows. It says, why is Bandon Dunes truly golf as it was meant to be? It's natural, unabashed, simple, honest, uncontrolled, beautiful, adventurous, and a thousand other things that man cannot dictate, design, or affect. So my question is, once you saw the land and you got sort of the green light from Mike Kaiser, how long did it take you to design that masterpiece? And what, for you, at least as a designer, what were the challenges along the way?
The design process took a couple of years, but that also included the permitting process. And prior to starting construction at Bandon, there really wasn't a lot of design as your listeners might think it is. I mean, it's not like there was dozens of big blueprints with all the detail of a bunker or a green shape. It was really just a routing plan that showed where the holes were laid out, and maybe some small sketches of how a hole might come together. But they were very basic. The real design, all of the nuance, is in the field, and it's still like that today. I mean, most of the work that we do, the vast majority of the design work that golfers would really react to, is in the field. We're moving stuff around with our team on the ground every minute of every day, trying to find the most interesting, most exciting, most fun golf shots to present to a golfer to make them scratch their heads and smile and think, oh, I got this, I could do this, I could score here. So the real design of Bandon Dunes was when we started construction in August of 97 through until the next summer. That 8 month period, I was there every minute of every day with the guys on the ground saying, hey, let's put a bunker over here. No, that didn't really work very well. Take that one out. Let's put it over here instead. Let's shape this green this way. Okay, make it a little bigger, make it skinnier, pitch it this way or that way. So it's really like sculpting. You start with the block of stone and you've got a sketch that okay, I'm going to sculpt, the boy David, but all you've got is a sketch and a block of stone. All of the nuance is when you've got the chisel in your hand and you're actually making the statue. And it's the same with great golf course design. The designer is there sculpting.
And David McClay Kidd, you said the level of what you were creating, you truly had to be there every day, didn't you?
I did. But I also needed some really talented people around me. I had one particular guy, Jim Haley, who was the shaper on the bulldozer with me. And so much of Bandon Dunes is he and I. He's the guy in the equipment. I don't run the equipment, although some architects do. I do not. So I'm there, dragging my toe in the sand. I'm planting flags. I'm making little sketches for him, and we're saying, hey, let's do this, let's do that. And he's reacting. He's like, well, that's a good idea, but maybe we could do this or that differently. And so there's a collaboration on every golf course project between the architect and the guy actually in the seat of the equipment making those shapes. And that collaboration hopefully leads to something even better than the architect may have originally thought.
Hey, David, let me ask you a question. How many golf courses or golf course projects, I should say, are you and your team working on at any one time?
That's a tough one. We try and not be building more than about three. Three is about the maximum that we can actually build at any one time, because if you want to spend a lot of time there and each trip is taking the better part of a week, if you're building three at once, that's 3 weeks out of every month. And at some point, you want to make sure you're not getting divorced. And since I've already done that a couple of times, I'm trying to avoid it. So about three is the most you could possibly build for us, at least at one time. But in order to have three in construction, you need to have a lot that are in pre-development. So we could be working on a dozen projects or more all at the same time, with our team in our office here in Bend, working through all the engineering and environmental and permitting and budgeting and scheduling, and moving them up the through the process in order to get them out into the field. And of course, they don't all come to construction at the same time. So one could be just starting while another one is halfway through, while another one is finishing, and another one's about to start. So it's a sequential process. And for me, in a perfect world, I'm doing the creative part on one project at a time. And for me, 30 plus years into this, I usually go to the projects. I'm headed to Streamsong 2 weeks from now to start work there,
Yes,
and
you are.
I'll be working on the first couple of holes. And strangely enough, at Streamsong, it will actually be the first couple of holes, one and two, which is unusual. We usually end up building them in a weird sequence, but for whatever reason, we're actually starting on the first one and two and three. So I'll spend a few days there and really concentrate on those holes. What are the moves we're going to make? What are going to make these holes particularly memorable and fun for the golfer? And I'll really focus in on that. And then on each successive trip, I'm usually focusing on a small group of holes, two or three holes. I might be looking at everything else, but I'm focusing on only two or three. And then I'll go away for a couple of weeks. The guys will keep doing what they're doing, and then I'll return, focus on another couple of two or three holes. And that goes on for probably 6 months to get through the design construction part of the golf course. And then you have irrigation and grassing and all of the other parts of it following in behind. But once the creative part is done, my role starts to step down a little bit. I've got other guys in my team who can handle the irrigation and grassing and all those other things where I don't need to be quite so Johnny on the spot. But that usually half the construction period is very intense, and I'm there a lot, as much as I can possibly be there.
I just want to say, David, that you have made your father so proud. It is incredible. You can't do anything better in this lifetime than making your father proud. And I say, congratulations, David kid. You're a tribute to the game of golf.
Well, I appreciate that, sir, and making my father proud. My father's been my hero, my whole life. So thank you very much for saying that. There's nothing gives me more pleasure than him giving me an attaboy, even as I approach my 60th year and he approaches his 80th. His attaboys mean more than anything else.
I wish I could get one more attaboy from my dad. I understand the feeling. Bob, great question. It kind of dovetails. So David, we've got a couple questions left. I always ask the same question at the end of each one, and that'll certainly that'll resonate with you. But before that, talk a little bit about what you're able to do going from project to project as a pilot. Not something that every architect is doing, flying from venue to venue. When did the bug hit you, the desire to be a pilot? How often do you fly, et cetera?
Back in 2012, we were coming out of the recession, and a buddy of mine suggested I go take an introductory flying lesson. And I thought he was kidding. I'd flown in plenty of small planes in my life, but only ever in the back. But I took him up on it. It was $60. Came out to the local airport, flew up in a little Cessna for an hour, and I was absolutely hooked. The freedom of being able to take to the skies and go where you want. And what I didn't realize that first day was it's not like a driver's license. You're not gonna go take some lessons and 6 weeks later they give you a permit and away you go. When I asked the instructor, so how long would it take me to get in a plane that I could fly across the US? He laughed and he said, well, if you did it in 5 years, I'd be impressed. And he was right. It probably took me almost 5 years to get to the point where I was qualified and experienced enough to fly an aircraft, sophisticated enough to be able to fly all across the United States. But I've been doing that now for, the better part of a decade. And it really, really makes the one part of the job much more bearable. I mean, the travel is the real bugbear. That's the part that really, really takes the toll. I mean, being on the road 200 days a year, I could tell you some stories. Last year I did 250,000 miles in a year. That's 10 times around planet Earth, and I only left the US once. I was asked how many nights did I spend in a hotel. And I retorted with, I spent 52 nights just in a Fairfield Inn, not in any other brand. I stayed in those brands. I could probably give you another dozens of days, but just in the Fairfield Inn, I spent 52 days. So
You got plenty of points off of
Fairfield Inns
that.
are great, but 250,000 miles, 200 days on the road, dozens and dozens of days. So having an airplane means that I can leave here on a Monday, touch 2-3 projects during the week and still be back on Friday. And my wife thinks life is still worth living. I didn't completely abandon it.
And it's all under your control, right? You control it as opposed to being under the whims of the airlines, et cetera. It's huge.
And funny enough, I am sitting in the back of our aircraft right this second with the doors shut because it's nice and warm. And I'm talking to you from the cabin.
That's a first.
Bob, that's got to be a first for you, isn't it?
That is.
Hey, David, final question. I think you've kind of hinted on what the answer might be earlier. If you could have a David McClay kid, a dream foursome, three other individuals with whom, and if you want it to be four others, that's fine, with whom you could play a sort of a magical round of golf, whether those individuals are living or no longer with us, who would those three or four be and where would you play? I have an idea where you'd play that round of golf, but where would you play?
Well, it'd obviously be on Macrahanish, the old course at Macrahanish. My dad would be the first pick I'd have in it. So that one's easy. But who would the other two be? Good grief. Now, you know, if I picked two players from my, you know, that my dad and I would love, it would probably be James Braid and Old Tom. You know, that would be a fun foursome. I guess my dad would pair with Old Tom and I'd take James Braid because he's, I think that'd be a good game. I don't know what ball we'd use.
I was going to say, what ball to use it? Who wins that match, do you think, huh?
That's a good question. I mean, Old Tom against James Braid, both very good golfers, both won the Open numerous times. So I don't know, but we're definitely splitting them up.
No, no question. Hey, Bob, final question for me, and then I know you want to wish David good luck. Being in South Florida, David, I've made that trek up to Stream Song several times, and it really is very much an experience similar to those who make the pilgrimage out west to Bandon Dunes. When you connect with Stream Song, do you pitch them that, hey, here's the idea that I have, or do they come to you? And are you sort of left to design what you feel is the right thing or what they're looking for? How does that process work?
That process is different on every project. There's no one size fits all. At Stream Song, what happened was the owners, Kemper Sports, who also manage it, came to me and said, hey, we're talking to a few other design firms. We want to build another golf course. Would you like to come and take a look at the property we have and what we think is available, and we'll give you some of our initial thoughts, but we'd love you to react to that and give us your thoughts about how we could build the next great course at Stream Song. So over the course of last summer, I made numerous visits. Brad Boyd, the superintendent's become a good friend. We looked at lots of parcels of land, and my team and I, AJ Bridges is one of the design guys on my team, young, talented guy. He and I spent some time out there. And over the course of a few months, we went back and forth with various ideas until we came up with one that we really thought worked really, really well. And we drew that plan up into a very sexy master plan. And I presented it to Steve Skinner, the CEO of Kemper, at his office in Chicago. And, you know, I knew, experience told me that when I unwrapped this plan and showed him what we were going to do, I knew he would be like, oh yeah, that's definitely sexy. So I kind of knew that I'd have been shocked if it hadn't resonated with him. You know, we figured out a way to use the black clubhouse for the next course, which saves a huge amount of money. And it makes it so much easier for the golfer to operate out of, because now there'll be 36 holes out of both each clubhouse. And yet we did it in a way where the golf course is super exciting. You know, it disappears out of Black Clubhouse out to the west, and you get lost in all the sand dunes that sit between Black and Red. And then it reappears back into the back of Black's clubhouse. So I think that it's going to be a very exciting routing into land that people probably aren't looking at yet. When you're out there playing golf, you're probably unaware of where this new course is going. So I'm hoping that we can do something that gets in the mix and people can debate whether it's the number one or number four on their list. As long as it's
What's
not
the
always.
timeline? What's the timeline on that course opening?
It'll definitely open in 26. I don't know when in 26. I would expect it to be ready for the winter season of 26, 27. I mean, I'd be shocked if it wasn't. So I'd expect it to open in the fall of 26.
Say, Bob, what a guest. This has been fabulous.
Absolutely incredible. It's an honor and a privilege to talk to you, David. I can't congratulate you enough on the work that you do. You are a sheer genius. And once again, your dad is mighty, mighty proud.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate the invitation to come and chat with you, and I hope the listeners enjoy my Scottish ramblings.
Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William and Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William and Harry. Bob, the apple didn't fall very far from the tree when it came to David Kidd, his dad Jimmy Kidd. Well, he instilled a lot of pride and passion in his son, and you could hear it through the interview. What I just thought it was one of the coolest interviews that we've done.
No doubt about it. It was fascinating, and I know our listeners enjoyed listening to David. He was sensational.
Yeah, let's talk for a second. I mentioned about Brian Campbell, who won the tour event in Mexico. How about this for a statistic? The guy that he lost to, the young 20-year-old Aldridge Potgieter, he was first in driving distance last week, 326.9 yards. Who was last in driving distance? Brian Campbell, who won the tournament at 277 yards. And sometimes things just fall in place, right? This guy, he plays another product of Mike Small, the outstanding PGA professional, longtime golf coach at the University of Illinois, and Brian Campbell, a guy who he's had some injury issues the last few years. I even wondered if, heck, maybe I should pursue something else. Bob, sometimes in life, right, we persevere, and sometimes in life we just get a break. And he got the break that he needed on that second hole, and he took advantage of it. And look what happened.
You never know what's going to happen in the world of golf. That's what I love saying. Put your best foot forward, put your smile on your face, and give it your best. Lo and behold, good things are bound to happen.
Well, Campbell will be in the field, Bob, as the PGA Tour heads east. I'm going to miss you and Janice here at what was the Honda Classic forever. We had a few dinners out and maybe raised a toast here or there. It's now known as the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches, still played at PGA National, which is one of the sternest tests on the PGA Tour. Like, we had a lot of fun, Bob, for a number of years at Honda.
Yeah, and we really have to pay a huge tribute to Gary Furman. He has been a masterpiece at his capacity down at the Cognizant, formerly the Honda, one of the great all-time great tournaments on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, Gary has run the media center at what is now Cognizant for many years. Paid tribute earlier this week to our late friend Jeff Babineaux from Golf Week magazine and other publications who passed away suddenly in December. And I'm looking forward to going out there, Bob. The PGA Tour is nice enough to give me a credential for a couple of days. I've got a number of players I want to talk to. I think the biggest story of this week in many ways is Luke Clanton. Luke Clanton is the junior at Florida State who, just by making the cut on Friday, will earn his PGA Tour card. It's through the PGA Tour University Accelerated program, and he becomes eligible for that tour card after the NCAA championships this year. Bob, if you remember Clanton, he was the first amateur to finish with three top 10 finishes in a single year since Jack did it in 1961. This kid is legit. He's the top ranked amateur in the world. And while the field is not great, I mean, quite honestly, Bob, you've got a lot of these guys who play in the TGL simulator thing just down the road, literally from PGA National, who are not in the field. Most of them aren't. You've got a few. You've got Billy Horschel, and you've got Ricky Fowler and Shane Lowry and Minwoo Lee and Kevin Kisner, Cameron Young, but it's not a very strong field. But I think the Clanton story, Bob, is one that is really of interest.
Yeah, it kind of makes up for what's happening down the road. And congratulations to everybody at Cognizant. They're doing their best, and they will return to glory. Mark my words.
And mark my words, I want to close this with a personal note. My lovely daughter, Megan Elizabeth Elbin, turns 30 on Thursday, the 27th of February. Megan's a wonderful young lady. She works for a nonprofit in South Bend, Indiana. Great, a dear love for my daughter. And Bob, it's one of those things you wonder, where the heck did those years go? I still remember that little girl being born in a hospital in Michigan, outside of Detroit, Royal Oak, Michigan. 30 years later, what the heck just happened?
Well, it happens to all of us. And in your case, you were very fortunate. You raised a lovely, lovely, talented daughter, and you ought to be congratulated.
Yes, you're making this very special. Happy birthday to my daughter. Wishing everyone good luck in the field this week at the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches. And we sure hope you enjoyed hearing from David Kidd. He was absolutely terrific. For my good buddy, Bob Bubka, Kelly Elbin, signing off. Musings on Golf.